How's working from home been working for you? Remarkably Remote from GoToMeeting will help you succeed in today's new normal. In just 3 minutes or less, we'll share simple but helpful tips to keep you on track, from managing your motivation, workload, and relationships, to hosting and attending virtual events that keep you connected with your clients and colleagues. So check out Remarkably Remote on your favorite podcasting platform or head to gotomeeting.com/tips.
Happy Thursday, everyone.
Well, that felt weird.
But yes, happy Thursday. It is May 14th, 2020. Hope all you out there having a fantastic week. My name is Sean Oshadi, and my friends, this is the Man in the Myth podcast here on The Athletic. Welcome back to the show, y'all. Appreciate you guys. Hope you're staying safe out there. Hope everyone is doing well. You know, we have producer Chris here. He's here on the ones and twos. And with me, as always, is my guy. He is my East Coast spirit animal. He is the Keith Peterson of the MMA media, and he is also the best damn writer I know. He's the myth, the man in the hat. He is Chuck Mendenhall. What's shaking, pal? Two fight cards in 5 days, man. How you holding up?
A rare Thursday, huh, fella? This is like the old MMA beat days for me, like getting on the Thursday and talking about some fights. And I will say that that was accurate right off the top there. I do reek of alcohol, just like my boy, all right? So that's, you're one for one so far today.
When I think of alcohol and cigarettes, my mind goes to Chuck Mendenhall. I've been out with you too many times in Las Vegas.
Yeah. Oh, what a start.
Before we even get into it, as I said, two fight cards in 5 days. And these have been very different viewing experiences than most, to me at least. They've been very unique. And I want to jump right into this because it seems like people are really enjoying that aspect of it for the most part. We're hearing coaches, we're hearing fighters talk, we're hearing these mid-fight exchanges like the kind we heard last night in this main event. Glover Teixeira apologizing to Anthony Smith mid-beatdown, and Anthony just kind of being like, well, you know, yeah, man, it is what it is. Like,
yeah, so calm, so collected.
We've been cage side a thousand times at these events, and these aren't even exchanges you would be aware of cage side just because it's so loud. Where do you guys stand on this two events in? Because I'll tell you what, I am not missing having a loud arena in there. I'm actually kind of loving this like raw, unglossy look at MMA that we're getting right now.
I am too, man. And honestly, like this particular one, I started paying more attention to that. And obviously, and during the Ricky Simone Ray Borg fight, obviously, Ricky heard them talking about how big he is, and he flexes like mid fight. This is when it hits you. You're like, this is so crazy. It's like they can hear everything that's going on. But it also kind of, as you watch a second event unfold, it makes you wonder to what extent, like, say, judges can hear the commentary, right? And maybe they're steered into a different direction off of commentary. How much the referees can hear the commentary. Things like that.
Opposing teams even, because at one point, you have Paul Felder over there saying, like, oh, Mark Henry said, I forget what he said, but Mark Henry said this, that means that. And DC's like, dude, they can probably hear you. Maybe don't say that. It's a bizarre situation.
I know, it is bizarre. And there were times, which was really funny, too, because it was Felder himself who I thought was very aware of his voice being too loud. So he was talking in these very hushed tones. Like, and it's just funny, man. I mean, the whole thing is just such a unique experience. And I think that in the new fighting world, or at least the temporary future of the fighting world, they're going to have to figure all this out. But watching it in its like first stages of how all this plays out has been a lot of fun, actually.
Yeah, I'm really enjoying it. And I actually felt like for this event versus 249, there sounded to be more noise in the arena. Just the corners felt a little looser. I think the fighters were more willing to do it. Like, I think as this keeps going, I think you're going to hear more and more chatter. I don't think it's going to get less. I think people are trying to fill the room, even though, you know, that's impossible because it's an empty arena. But I like it. I find it interesting. It's just another thing to deal with. And that Glover Teixeira, Anthony Smith interaction is just so wild, man. It's so crazy.
It's really one of those that just makes you, I don't know, it makes you do a double take. It makes you think about what we're all doing here. Just, I don't know, man.
Yeah.
Let's jump into that main event because you guys kind of alluded to it a little bit, but Glover Teixeira, just a one-sided beatdown, frighteningly one-sided. Glover Teixeira wins Wednesday night, fifth round TKO. He lands over 200 strikes on Anthony Smith, and it became almost uncomfortable to watch. The end felt very merciful on this one. It was honestly, I mean, just for me, it was a very hard viewing experience by the end because we're just out here Chuck, you and I have talked to Anthony Smith before. He's a very nice guy, very intelligent guy. To sit there and watch him just get pulverized by beyond any reasonable measure out there was tough. But now at age 40, you have Glover Teixeira tied with the longest active win streak in this light heavyweight division. It all feels very improbable with him, but he is keeping this alive, man. What was your biggest takeaway from what we saw Wednesday night?
Kind of more of the same, to be honest, although I felt like Glover looked more vicious than ever. Maybe it was just the optics of the fight playing out too long, but what he was landing, those uppercuts and some of that stuff on the dirty boxing on the fence, things like that, where he would back him up and then just unload. I was like, this guy seems like he's getting stronger and more merciless as time goes on. If anything, correct me if I'm wrong, but I thought that Anthony Smith actually looked pretty good the first two rounds. Like, he was landing, as long as they kind of kept it in space, it was in the middle of the cage. I felt like the exchanges were going more Anthony's way. It really just started to change. He got cracked in that third round. I think his orbital, that's when it happened, because you see him just basically cover up. And from that point on, it just seemed like an onslaught. I mean, it was just like, from that point on, it just seemed like he was surviving. And I think everybody had the exact same feeling, which was like, how much longer do we have to watch this guy take this punishment? You know what I mean? And it played out very gratuitous in the end. Like, it went too long, and that part was weird. But man, great performance by Glover Teixeira. And what can you say about him, man? Like, I feel like he has to get beat up a little bit to come to life in these last four fights. But when he does, man, he just, like, it's brutal. The guy's like, he's a wrecking machine once he comes to life.
Yeah, Anthony Smith was he looked great in that first round. And it's interesting. I'm interested to see what you guys think about it, because DC was saying that he felt like Anthony Smith's corner team was being so overbearing and so, you know, wall to wall with their instruction to him, that they maybe were forcing him to keep a higher pace than he should have been keeping at that point, and that hurt him later in the fight. I do agree. I think he did get the orbital injury or broken nose or whatever early, and that kind of he suffered the rest of the way through. But on the other side, Glover Teixeira looked fantastic. I mean, that's a guy you do not want to get in trouble in front of, because he has the arsenal to put you down. And, you know, the other thing with that, he took some shots, but he took them well. It's not like a guy that's getting chinny at 40 years old. Like, he looks like he can take a shot and give a shot. Really impressive performance. I mean, I think we're probably going to get into it, but he is legitimately putting himself back into the title picture.
Dude, he's like a top five fighter right now.
100%.
Like, that's a real thing, which is crazy. We'll get to that in a second. I just want to say this. This is Anthony Smith's list of injuries from last night. Broken nose, broken orbital, two missing teeth, cut under his right eye. You go to the missing teeth. One is in the front and one's towards the back. They're his real teeth. Coach Mark Montoya, he was the same coach who last October, if you remember, let Thomas Gifford just get absolutely wrecked by Mike Davis for like 15 minutes before he finally just face planted in the closing seconds of that fight. And if you remember, Michael Bisping was commentating that fight, and he was livid, just livid about what was going on, what he was watching, because Gifford just ends up eating a ton of unnecessary damage. And I mean, we were talking about this with Ferguson Gaethje, but dude, those are the kind of fights that can change a fighter. And coincidentally enough, obviously you can't say there's a correlation here, but Gifford got released by the UFC after that, and he lost his first fight afterwards in the regional scene in 33 seconds via KO. Like, fights like these stay with fighters forever. And last night it felt like we reached that point, man. Like, it is jarring when it feels like the fighters know it's over, but the corners don't. And to a lesser extent, the referee too. Because to me, it felt like Anthony showed every sign last night that he wanted to be let out. He's out here saying, my teeth are falling out. I've never heard that.
No, man.
Between rounds. And yet his corner sent him back out there for that fifth round to just get demolished after two 10-8s back to back, just get demolished for another 64 seconds. I really just hope Anthony Smith is the same down the line, because this is a man who is now 31 years old, career filled with wars, but never anything like that, man. No. Like, I love Mark. He's a fantastic coach. You hear nothing but good things about him, anybody who trains with him. But this is now twice within a very short span for him. I wonder, is this an MMA problem, a Mark Montoya problem, or a little bit of both?
Probably a little bit of both, man. I think that it's a good opportunity, because honestly, I feel like this is the one, it swells up like this where there are moments where people actually pay attention, they scrutinize this type of thing. It has to be almost be a perfect storm for people to really pay attention to the corners and what it would take for them to throw in the towel and save their guy and all that stuff. I think that it's obviously it falls on him, and you wonder like his thought process on it. I saw he took full accountability for the loss in the end. Like, he was basically, I think he told Brett Okamoto, like, I take blame for the loss, whatever. But you want him to, you know, you would hope in the heat of the moment, like, maybe they are guarded against, or maybe they have some kind of secret contract between them. I feel like these guys talk about these types of things all the time. Like, they wouldn't forgive their coach. So part of it is the fighter. You don't know exactly the agreement, but man, you would like to see these guys that just would read body language and honestly be able to sift through a statement. Like, if you say that I'm losing teeth out there, to me, man, if somebody came and said that, and I'm a trainer, I'm probably saying, you think of a guy like Trevor Whitman, who has been very empathetic towards his fighters, and he has, you know, intervened or said, I'm going to stop this fight. You know, like, he's thinking in that term first, you know. You'd like to
especially
see more guys do that.
Especially after back-to-back 10-8 yeah. rounds, man.
Exactly. This fight was not going anywhere. I know what... You look at Anthony Smith, where he's at in his career, trying to get back to a guy like John Jones, maybe trying to get Thiago Santos again. Like, he's 50 fights. You understand what this fight means, right? Like, you understand where he's at. But he wasn't, I mean, after he started covering up in the third round, it was clear something had happened. It had clicked with him. He didn't want to get hit. You could see it. It was going through, he was going through lots of moments where he's like, he did not want to get hit wherever he was broke. You know what I mean? And after seeing that, man, you're just like, you hope that you can read body language a little more and understand that the situation changes, right? So hopefully, if Mark looks back on this and, you know, it's tough for me to sit here and to say, like, what he should do. But if he goes back and he looks at the film, maybe he can identify for himself, like, you know what, man, maybe that would have been a smart time to intervene.
Yeah, I mean, to me, I think if there was any opportunity, forget about throwing in a towel, although I think that is something that, you know, could have been considered there between the fourth and fifth round when he's saying the stuff about his teeth. Yeah. That's when you go, look, Anthony, I'm going to stop this. Like, it's not on you anymore. You know, like, take it out of his hands, because he's a war. I mean, Lionheart, that's not a joke. I mean, the guy's a warrior. He survived 15 minutes or more impressively. You know what I mean? It's like he took a ridiculous beating because he's so tough. Yeah. Because he's a skilled guy, he obviously sustained a lot of damage. Just stop it. There's no shame in that. Nobody would have been upset about that stoppage. And I also wonder, though, there's a few opportunities in there, I think, for Jason Herzog to stop that fight.
Sure.
But because when Anthony gets up, he lands a big shot or he throws an elbow or whatever, he's still fighting. I get that. But it just never felt like he was going to make that comeback and win that fight. And Glover, on the other hand, looked fresh as a daisy and was throwing bombs the whole time. Something was missed there, and it's tough to watch especially because it's such a good guy in Anthony Smith and a tough guy. But something should have been done either by the corner, I think, or the ref definitely could have found an opportunity to stop it there.
See, the tough thing was Glover never, like, he kept going for submissions. Every time he, like, there was a point there in the third round, I think it was the third round, might have been the fourth, where he really badly knocked down Anthony Smith, and it looked like it was over. And if he would have just, Daniel Cormier was saying this all night, if he just rains down like 10 punches, that fight's probably over. But
yeah, but he's apologizing to him. He probably didn't want, that's the thing. It's like that weighs on Glover too. He's
apologizing. But it ends up being much worse. It ends up being much, much worse with the way it plays out, and sort of this long, very sustained, very just one-sided, again, beating that Anthony Smith ends up taking, man. It ends up playing out much worse than if it just gets finished in that third.
Yeah, I did not understand, to be honest, man. I'm watching the fight, and Glover Teixeira, when he has him hurt and he goes for that first submission, I was like, dude, if you throw two or three more punches, this is over. You could see that the referee was actually probably the closest he came to stopping the fight at that moment, you know? It just seemed like it was like one of those weird sequential things that kind of repeated itself through the fourth round and just became very unfortunate in the end. But I think if Glover could do it again, I'm sure he would have tried to just, you know, finish the fight at that moment.
You know, the other thing that I was thinking too in watching it, obviously we know a broken nose, a broken orbital, but I mean, these are horrendous things to deal with. He didn't look that bad. You know what I mean? His teeth are falling, but like he didn't, when you looked at Tony Ferguson looked like he went through a wood chipper. I mean, he looked horrible at the end of that fight. Anthony obviously is swelling and whatever, but he didn't look horrendously. So, you know, I don't know how much that plays into it. I mean, that's just me reading into it.
I think body language, though, like his body language was much worse than Tony's was. And at some point you have to read that, whether you're Herzog or whether you're Mark Montoya or whoever. At some point, somebody needs to save Anthony from himself. There were
extended moments where he was just turtling up. I mean,
yeah.
And I at any of those moments, and obviously, like, as self-preservation, I'm sure at some point, like, after a few seconds, I was like, okay, I better fight back. It's not getting stopped. It almost felt like we were caught in that kind of, you know, like, Ouroboros or something. Like, you couldn't find the exact moment, but, like, there were several times where you see him take a shot, and another shot where he was already hurt, and he would just turtle up. His instinct was like, no more, I don't want – you could see it. And I was like, oh, somebody do something. But, man – it's a tough thing.
Well, and again, we talk about the quiet arena. The quiet arena last night almost made it much worse because you're just hearing the sickening thud from each of these shots, shot after shot, man. It was just, you hope Anthony Smith is the same. You really do. Moving forward, this is a guy at 31 years old, prime of his career. You hope this doesn't affect him in these next, you know, however many fights he has over these next many years.
You have to assume it's going to affect him a little bit, even if just mentally, I mean, to have been taken to that place. But also I think something that we're seeing, we saw it with Tony Ferguson. Now we see it with Anthony Smith, and I'm sure there's other guys on the card that I'm not thinking of right now, but these guys that have been in extended camps leading into this, you know, the restart of these events, you're seeing that they're having problems. So, I mean, that's something definitely to keep an eye on as we go forward.
That's absolutely a great point. On the flip side of this, let's talk about Glover Teixeira for a second, because you guys are right. This late career resurgence is wild at this point. I mean, 40 years old, four fights in a row now. As I said, tied with the longest active streak in the division. This is a guy who I think a lot of people, myself included, totally wrote off a couple years ago when he went 2-3 around that 2016-2018 range. He went 2-3. He was kind of losing to people that he used to be able to beat. On Monday, we even called him a mid-level gatekeeper. Like, that was how he was being used by the UFC. But he really did look surprisingly great last night. Did you guys ever see this coming? One, is this legit, and how far do you think he can actually take this?
Well, it feels legit now. I think when we were coming into this, I was pointing out in our little preview that he was getting beat up in the Robertson fight and the Cutelaba fight. Like, these were fights that he was losing until he started to come back and take the fight. I felt like this one was kind of similar, like, because he was getting nicked up a little bit in that first round, a little bit in the second round. It kind of had that feeling. But, man, at this point, dude, like, the way he was so poised in the pocket and under fire, and you could see his chin is not a problem. You know what I mean? Like, he was absorbing shots. I know that after he got knocked out a couple times earlier, I think it was the Anthony Johnson one, and then Gustafson later, like, there was like, he's getting older, man. His chin is not going to hold up. And he's kind of defying all of that definition. Like, I think he's fine that way. At this point, dude, it's just on straight stubbornness and defiance and just wiliness of being an old veteran like that and fought so many guys. He's right there, man. And I can't say that I ever saw that coming. I can't say that I ever saw it, even during this run. So this is a completely surprise development.
Yeah, it's really surprising, but maybe it shouldn't be, because out of all of the contenders, I mean, you start to rank them, he's right up there in terms of excitement, in terms of style, his ability. He can take fights to the ground. He obviously can strike. That's what's interesting about it. And like you said, Chuck, a guy at his age, he can take a shot. That's the first thing you start to notice. If guys can't take the shot, then you start worrying about the matchups that you're putting him in. Obviously, he can. So, I mean, improbably... he's up there. And also, you brought up the Rumble Johnson knock. It's like, Rumble Johnson can knock anybody out.
Sure.
And Gustafson, that performance was arguably the best performance of Gustafson's career. So it's like,
that is true too.
You know, maybe you take those as a little bit of an outlier, and then now look what he's doing. So he's absolutely, I mean, it's really incredible, and he's in the mix, and he legitimately should be in the mix.
Just makes you think, how hard does Rumble Johnson hit to be able to do that to that guy in 13 seconds, dude? Unreal, man. That knockout gets more and more impressive the farther away we get from it. Last thing on this, just because this has sort of now led us to a very weird place, what the hell is going on at light heavyweight? Like, the top five is the weirdest top five that I can think of in any division. You have Jones Reyes up there, and then in some order, you got Jan Blachowicz, Thiago Santos, and a 40-year-old Glover Teixeira in the year 2020. Like, yeah. Again, when it comes to ultra bizarre top fives, that has to be the weirdest in the entire UFC, right?
Yes. And that division has been, I mean, for years now, ever since John Jones basically began to dominate and, you know, and Cormier during his time there, like, it has always been very weird at the top. But this, I think, is the most unexpected alignment of names at the top that you could expect, right? Because I felt like Thiago Santos, like, given the fact that he moved up in weight and things like that, but like a couple of those guys are dudes you never would have thought would make it into that realm that are in there, you know what I mean? And then guys like Glover Teixeira, you'd think they're done. And there's always a guy that starts to have a late resurgence or something like that. But I mean, come on, it's usually a guy that's like in his mid-30s or something like that. Like, this is just, it's a very, very weird development. But I guess that's what makes fighting what it is. You know what I mean? It's just, you just don't know from fight to fight or from year to year what's going to happen. And that's Exhibit A, man. Just go look at that. Go look at the top like 10 guys in the light heavyweight division, and you'll see what I'm talking about there.
This is what happens, though, when you have a guy like John Jones at the top of the division. You get these rightful contenders that get up there. He puts them back down. And then you just kind of have this, like, circular firing squad.
And then they
guys.
Just destroy themselves, you know what I mean?
Underneath. Exactly, right. Yeah. And then, you know, that's what's happening here, I think.
Unreal, man. It's just, if you're John Jones and you're looking at this light heavyweight division, there are no real big fights for you left other than this Reyes fight. It's the strangest division right now. But let's move on. Let's keep it moving, and I want to talk about, to me, this felt like the second biggest story coming out of this card, and none other than this man, an honorary lifetime member of Team Handsome, Drew Dober. Dude, what can you say about who this guy has become? Back in 2016, Drew Dober was teetering on the verge of unemployment. He starts his UFC career just 3 wins in his first 8 fights. It looks like he's going to be just another generic guy out there in the lightweight division. And now suddenly, I don't know, like he might be one of the division's hottest contenders. He's 6-1 over his last 7, knockouts in the last 3, looks sensational last night, fast, I'd say powerful, technical. He's out there sparring with Justin Gaethje every week. You guys know how I feel about the quiet guys who get on these long streaks. That's my jam. That is my jam. And you look at this guy, former baker, he's out here, he can make you donuts. He can make you strawberry shortcake cookies in the middle of a global pandemic.
Chris, don't laugh. He can do it.
No, I'm laughing because I know it's true.
He's out here power baking when he gets frustrated. And now he's just murdering lightweights left and right.
Yep.
I think Drew Dober might be one of my guys.
Yeah. I was waiting for that.
Dude, what can you say about this guy at this point? The quiet evolution, because this is not going to be quiet anymore after what we saw last night.
I think it's great that a guy like this does roar up at some point, because honestly, he's kind of like you just mentioned, he's a baker. He has these weird things about his history that are always interesting, but it doesn't seem like people kind of latch on, like outside the bubble a little bit. Do you remember though, he fought Nick Hine and he meets his sister and marries her. Like he marries Nick Hine's sister. Plus he, like, before the marriage, he had like a fight. I believe it might've been the Scott Holzman one, where he took the fight and then they get married, but he wanted to have the black eye at the wedding. Like, he was, I wanted to have a black eye, you know? And I was like, I remember doing a story on this years ago, and I was just like, who is this kid, man? Like, he's like, he has such a different mindset, but he's a breath of fresh air. He's very down to earth kind of guy. I think he's got like an organic and true like personality. Like, it's like he kind of tells you what's on his mind. He's a very benevolent type of guy, but then he gets in there and he's been tearing these guys up, and it feels like, of course, he's been there. He was right under our noses the whole time. This guy's like this amazing fighter. But for whatever reason, I really believe these last 2 fights have been the ones to open my eyes. And the first one happened just earlier this year. And it, you know, I think that that was eye-opening, the one he fought at. Who's the cat he fought?
Nazrat Haparas. I think I might have made that correct. One of my locks. Yes. I think I screwed up on
you
that.
You did. That was a surprising performance. I mean, he really looked great.
And so, like, but just to get that first round, like in the first minute type of knockout, and then now this one, and it felt very like, keep an eye on Drew Dober. Like, people, I felt like people were kind of saying that, and for him to come through with that kind of performance, man, I felt like this was a big moment for him, man. I felt like he kind of stole the show a little bit, and he made the story about him. And I feel like everybody has to have that that kind of moment before they start to truly, you know, make gains in the sport.
It's kind of a lesson in patience, right? Like, I feel like we get a lot of these where this guy comes along out of nowhere, and we've written him off as, you know, hey, he's just going to be this person for the rest of his career. And then all of a sudden he changes the dynamic, flips the script overnight. And yet we get so many of these, and yet we always seem to forget to follow that patience, to be patient with these guys. Drew Dober has, at this point at least, had a very RDA-esque type of career path.
I agree.
Like, he was kind of middling for a good long while, and now all of a sudden he has exploded into this powerhouse who's catching bodies and carving up scalps left and right. It's crazy.
It's all that training with Justin Gaethje, right?
That's exactly right, man. I was looking at that. I was going to say, I'm looking at that matchup, like I do my picks on Verdict, and I was going back and forth because Hernandez is coming off a loss, and I figured he would come back and try to look as good as he possibly could. But then obviously you're saying the Nasrat Haqparast fight, Drew Dober looked great in his last performance. And then I realized that he's been spending time training with Justin Gaethje, and I switched my pick, and man, did that guy not disappoint. And he stole the show. He really did. For me, that was the most impressive performance of the night. Glover notwithstanding, obviously it's kind of like a weird situation, but
yeah,
Drew Dober just looked great from beginning to end.
I really don't know what's in the water out there in Denver, because Team Elevation is just on fire right now. And the similarities between Drew Dober's win and Justin Gaethje's win, the standing TKOs, like, they were kind of mirror images of each other. Not, there's a lot of differences obviously there, but just the way the actual finishing sequence was very similar. And those finishes are just brutal in a silent arena like that, where you can just see someone breaking like that. It's wild to watch. Now you look at this guy, he is at this point where he is going to start facing these top 15, top 10 guys. Drew called out Paul Felder afterwards, which I thought Paul handled that in a very professional manner.
he's had to handle that situation a lot recently, man. It's funny.
Dude, every time he's on the mic, he's getting called out by somebody, and usually there are fights that wouldn't do much for him.
Yeah.
I don't really like that fight much. I like the attempt, but I think Paul deserves somebody bigger.
Yeah,
but what do you guys like for him? Because I'll tell you two names that came up for me. Carlos Diego Ferreira. That was the fight that was supposed to happen, and I still like it. I still sort of think they're in similar places in the lightweight division. It'd be interesting. But also, I think my number one, Anthony Pettis, who just fought Donald Cerrone on Saturday. Timelines match up. Feels like Drew kind of deserves that fight.
Man, that's an interesting one. That one hadn't occurred to me, but like, I like that on a lot of reasons, right? Like, I think Dober needs a guy, especially an ex-champion, a guy who has kind of a brand and a name. You know what I'm saying? Like, people tend to remember that type of performance. So I think that would be a next logical step for him. That would have some kind of import. Like, if he's able to go in there and do the same thing, I feel like it would have some meaning for him in terms of launching himself forward. But yeah, man, I would be okay with either one of those fights. The great thing about him is he's such an action fighter, or whatever he's realized about his game and his confidence and everything. You could plug him in against a lot of those guys, man. And I think suddenly it seems more like an important fight. It seems like an action fight. And it's kind of exciting because that division is always, you know, roiling with these guys who are you can kind of mix and match, and it makes sense. But adding Drew Dober to that, I think it's about to get a lot more fun.
Yeah, I'd be down with either one of those fights. It'd be interesting to see what Showtime wants to do. Obviously, he fought at 170 in his last one, so who knows if he wants to go back down to lightweight. But definitely the Diego Fajeda fight is that feels right. I mean, I don't know if that's like the biggest name for people who are casually paying attention, but that's a fantastic matchup for both of them, and it can vault both of them into higher than the top 10 there.
This lightweight division, man, endless stream of talent. Every single week it feels like there's a new guy that we have to keep our eye on. It's unreal. I love it. I absolutely love it. I don't know liked it. Dude, have you liked a division more ever in the history of the sport than this current modern lightweight division? Because I think this might take it for me.
That's a tough one, but I mean we've seen so many iterations, but I think that the depth of talent right now is better than it's ever been. I mean,
it's so
the
good.
Yeah, like when you mention guys like Drew Dober who are just coming in, I feel like there's a lot of those guys. There are a lot of dudes in there right now who are just so good. Like, that top 15 is ridiculous. So it's like, in just depth of talent and intrigue of matchmaking, yeah, I think this is probably the best it's been.
Yeah, I agree. He's going to be, he'll be like 15 or 14 in that division. And he looks like a guy who could easily be in the top, you know, 8 or whatever in any other division.
Seriously, to just make it into the top 15 in this lightweight climate right now is a huge accomplishment itself. Whereas you get other divisions like a heavyweight where it's like one or two wins will get you there. Let's keep it moving. So many storylines actually coming out from this event last night. It was actually a little bit, I think, underrated in my mind. Maybe we underrated a bit too, because there were a lot of leftover questions and threads to pull. So we're going to do a quick five rounds. All of these are going to be very fast, but we're just going to hit the rest of the topics real quick. And I want to start here. Ben Rothwell, Alexi Olynyk, yay or nay? Because I am so yay.
Dude, why not, man? I feel like Ben Rothwell's on, it's like, it's on House Money, right? Like, he just keeps winning. Olynyk, the same thing. So it's like, put them together. I would be intrigued, man.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Watching it, when I heard him say it, I yelled, I was like, oh, hell yeah. I told my TV that was a good call. So yeah, I'm down with that one.
We got to start getting a surveillance cam on him while he's watching these fights.
Dude, that's the weirdest fight that I've never thought about that I suddenly very much want.
It's only because it's all recent development. Then you're like, well, why not? You know, it's kind of fun.
Oh, I love it. Second round. OSP at heavyweight. Couple things here. He didn't win, but I found myself very intrigued by how he acquitted himself, because OSP clearly has the power, I think, and the speed to be successful down there. He weighed in at 240, so he's not really undersized at all. And it felt like once he realized that he had the physical tools to measure up to Ben, that he was kind of holding his own in there just fine. He even dropped Ben a couple times. I wonder if this could be a viable path forward for him. But really, my biggest thing about this fight, did you guys see John Jones's reaction?
Yes.
Sure did.
Oh, man.
The John Jones thing is becoming like, you know, we always expect to hear from Conor McGregor on fight nights, right? Like, especially for ones that pertain to him, he's going to jump in there. But the John Jones weighing in is always a little bit crueler and a little bit lacking in empathy. It's a little bit tone deaf compared to what everybody's experienced. It's so different. It's almost like it's become must see for me to like tune into his Twitter at this point.
It's bad. Did you see the tweet he put out where he was like, who caught the deleted tweet of the night or whatever? Like, he's such a lunatic on there. It's great. I love John Jones on Twitter. It's so fun.
He's still nipping. No, I'm just kidding.
So this one, this exchange, this got me going, guys. This got me going a little bit. I'm gonna read this just quick exchange. This was John last night. Quote, man, it was weird seeing OSP fight at heavyweight. Made it seem so much more real for me, especially knowing he was at 240. With a little more cardio, he would have been. And then a cherry emoji. I don't know what that's supposed to, like, I don't know the lingo there. Is it supposed to mean something? But I don't know. We get what he's trying to say. I was visualizing myself as him that whole fight. And then Francis Ngannou comes into the picture and quote tweets this and says, how real it seemed to you, my friend.
Yeah.
And then John Jones answers, seems so real, Francis. All that power means nothing when your haymakers are too slow. I'm not most, my friend. To which John followed up this morning, which really got me going.
Yes.
Who would you guys consider the quicker or more technical striker, Thiago Santos or Francis? If you guys think I wouldn't take this fight, you're insane. I have absolutely nothing else to prove as a light heavyweight. I'd love that big money fight right around now. Send the deal.
Bro.
Y'all,
let's do it.
I'm getting sweaty thinking about this. What is your reading?
Come on. Well, first of all, you know me. I was the one who was after Jones's last one. I'm saying, like, I want to see him motivated and, like, bringing the best out of John Jones. I think you'd do that if he goes to heavyweight. And I, you know, you think about the Ngannou matchup, and it's like, oh my god, it changes everything to have something like that. If you want to get the most imagination into a fight in prospect for a John Jones fight, this is how you do it, right? Because I don't think anybody else he matches up with, of the guys he's fought or anybody coming up, holds even an ounce of the intrigue that him going up and fighting Francis Ngannou does. Dude, yeah. I love that fight. I want it so bad. I want it. I'm streaky.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. That one felt like it was not possible. Like, it just didn't seem like it was ever going to be something that we would see put together. But now for John to be saying send the deal, whatever, like, do it. I mean, you got to think Francis is ready to go, right? I mean, he was,
oh my god, this
seconds.
Is what Francis has been waiting for. Are you kidding me?
Yeah, so this is a slam dunk. It makes perfect sense. Winner gets a title shot, right? It just extends the heavyweight division a little bit, and this is an incredible
doesn't it solve too, like, obviously Ngannou being in a little bit of limbo as he waits out the Miocic Cormier thing. It's sort of like, well, wait a minute. There's this enormous fight that he could have, right?
That's what I mean. Better. It's perfect.
It's almost better for Francis. It is. Like, if I was Francis, I would choose that fight over the heavyweight title fight. That is the legacy fight. Like, you're the guy then who beat John if you end up beating him. Like, that's better than ever holding the heavyweight title.
True. And there's no shame in losing to John. You know what I mean? So it's kind of like, I like his... you know, you like the stakes for him in that fight.
Dude, that sells like 1.5 million pay-per-views.
I think you're right. I think that that, especially Ngannou coming off of what he just did. And I think this, it refreshes John Jones. I mean, I really do believe these last, it's been, it was necessary. He's coming off his suspensions and all the things going on. It was necessary to get him rolling again. Okay, fine. He fought some woodwork types of contenders. I hate using that word, but the guys who, you know, they were just next in line. It was getting things moving. Where is the imagination in his fights? I think that this is where it's at. I think we've been waiting to see what would happen. This would be huge, man.
I just hope he's not toying with our emotions.
He could like he be. See, that's the other part of this. He's a troll that way.
You know, he's completely I mean? A troll. I think he probably is, but I hope to God that he's not, because if we can somehow land this fight, oh man, yeah. I don't know that there is enough in this world to contain my excitement.
I'm with you, man.
Let's keep moving. Round three of this five rounds. Is Michael Johnson the most frustrating high-level fighter of our era?
Oh, man.
I think it occurred to me last night, as it seemed to occur to many, that this might be the most Michael Johnson loss that we have ever seen. Like, this was the Michael Johnson experience in a nutshell last night, losing to Thiago Moises in the way that he did. At this point, Michael Johnson may very well have the most bizarre resume that we have seen for any lightweight ever. Like, no one else in the UFC can claim to own wins over Ferguson, Poirier, Barboza, those three at the same time. Almost beats Justin Gaethje probably like three different times in their fight. And yet here we are, his career's in free fall. He's lost 8 of his past 11. And in many of those fights, just like last night, he's winning up until the exact second that he loses.
Mm-hmm.
Just as he did against Thiago Moises. It's become so predictable that I actually saw, I think, at least three different people tweet after round one, some version of like, well, is this where Michael falls apart? He looked really good after this first round. And then literally 25 seconds later, he does that. It's crazy, man.
Imagine he's being his coach. My God.
I can't even imagine how frustrating that must be. He's 33 years old. I feel like we've been waiting for the turnaround forever for when he's going to grow out of this. And at this point, it just kind of seems pretty clear that that might not happen. Yeah. Is this just who Michael Johnson will always be?
I think that that's exactly what it is. The dude's record now is 19-16. And even before he was on The Ultimate Fighter, right? Like, he had these moments. I know one of them was against James Krause way back. But, like, he had these moments where he lost fights where he should have been winning. And I feel like that's kind of where we just got caught in his, like, whatever it is. Like, his potential, maybe? Because I remember specifically when I was at ESPN, we did, like, we do sometimes. We're like, let's predict who's going to be a champion in the year. And I don't remember exactly what year it was, but back, you know, I had to have been like 2012-ish or something. And Brett Okamoto, I remember him saying like Michael Johnson. I was like, that's a great one, man. That dude has champion written all over him, because you see, if he brings it all together and the times he does, even in the course of one fight, you realize that he does have everything you kind of need, right? Like, he's got everything. But then he just, all of a sudden, he doesn't, and he loses a fight. And it's the most inexplicable, frustrating, strange, it's just all of that. It's just his career has just not panned out the way that it should have. He always have those victories, though, over those guys you mentioned, which kind of tells you that he is that he has it in him to do that. It's just, he just doesn't get it done. It's weird, man.
Yeah. I mean, you say 19-16, the guy could have 30 wins probably if you,
I know.
You know,
you go through. That's true.
You change all the ones that he was winning or should have been winning and ended up losing. But absolutely, you said it perfectly. That was the most Michael Johnson loss that Michael Johnson could have. Like, I wasn't surprised by it, unfortunately, but he looked good and then he didn't. And then the fight's over. And that's the story of his career.
Yeah.
He might be the most dangerous 500 fighter we've seen, man. Like, for his record, 19-16, like, that is so non-emblematic of his skills. Yeah. But it, I guess in a way it is emblematic of his skills. The whole thing is just very strange at this point.
And again, doesn't it make that fight a few fights ago of his between him and Artem Lobov, doesn't it just seem like we were watching a cult classic and we didn't realize it at the time? Because there's the other 500 fighter, right? Like,
there you go.
Like,
yeah.
The two 500 fighters going at it. It's kind of funny.
You're absolutely right, Chuck. Keeping it moving. Round four of this five rounds. Friend of the show, Brian Kelleher. This man might have a new nickname for himself. He calls himself Boom. He also should call himself the Contender Series Slayer, because I love what he is doing out here right now, man. This is two times in a row now where he has been the underdog to a contender series guy, and two times in a row now where he has gone out there and just put the wood to someone. just a perfect left hook last night to starch Hunter Azur. Azur comes in there undefeated, and Brian just swipes away that O from him. And he did something similar to Ode Osborne in January, another contender series guy. But then really it was this. I loved this. He sticks to the gimmick and he calls out the granddaddy of all contender series alums, the originator, the most famous of them all, Sean O'Malley. Quote, I told Dana White, get Sugar Sean, stop protecting this guy, get some joint papers, roll them up for me. I'm going to smoke his ass.
Look at this.
Dude, I love it. I love this fight. I love everything about this. We've been wondering who Sean O'Malley should face next. Do you guys share my enthusiasm for this matchup, or do you think Sean should probably get someone higher ranked?
Well, first of all, do you know what his turning point was, man? It's when he came on the Man in the Myth and he filled in for you.
Yep, exactly.
He didn't have original thoughts before then. But now, look at him, man. He knows how to articulate exactly what he wants. He learned a lot, man, from the show. No, you know what, man? Good for him. I love the fact that he is kind of doing this. Like, he's kind of going through, because I think he's almost a 2-1 underdog in both those fights. He just basically, went right through the guy. And, dude, it makes complete sense. It's a very smart call out to go, to call out O'Malley, who falls in line with kind of the trajectory of what he's doing, but also has that name. So I'm like, dude, if they can make that fight, I'm all about it.
Yeah, I'm absolutely. I think it's the right call out, whether it gets made or not. But I'm definitely interested in seeing that fight. And also, as predicted, he called for now having tie dye shorts. You see, I know it's part of the gimmick that he's going to smoke Sean O'Malley. But as I'm telling you, the floodgates are open now with those camo shorts.
You're all about that, man.
Yeah,
all about it.
We got Chris on this Reebok shorts beat. He's owning it. I love this fight. I was thinking of someone ranked for Sean, but this does feel like a good compromise to that, because Brian Kelleher continues that escalation. He's sort of that last guy before you get to the ranked people. Really like this fight. We'll see if they make it. Last round, last point from last night. Two decades in, we are still on the Andre Arlovsky story. This is crazy at this point. Let me tell you guys three stats about Andre Arlovsky. Number one, he debuted in the UFC in 2000. That's the year 2000. As in two decades ago. Seriously,
pre-Zufa.
He debuted? Dude.
It's like still dark ages. That's crazy.
UFC 28. UFC 28. Wow. We are at UFC 250 right now. And I'm not very good at math, but I'm pretty sure that's 222 pay-per-views later.
Yeah, that's about right. Yep.
Unreal. Point number two, stat number two. Three times in his career, he has lost four fights in a row. One of those was 9 years ago when we all left him for dead, myself included, after he flunked out of Strikeforce and then almost lost to Travis Fulton. And then another one of those was last year when he was out here losing to everyone under the sun and it just finally looked like it had happened. And now point number three, or stat number three, it's 2020. He's won two of his last three fights. This is incredible. None of his fights are even exciting anymore, and I don't even care. This is just amazing, and I love it. I have no idea how Andre Arlovsky is doing this.
I wish I had an answer to that. I want him to evolve to the point where he no longer is even throwing punches. You know what I mean? He's just out there just kind of... He's like, it's so weird because you remember back in the day, it was like you kind of expected him to get into a gunfight to an extent, power on power, and somebody would go down. His evolution has been very subtle, like this dialing back, increasing here. And it's undergone such, it's not even transformation. It's like poise or something. Like he's showing up in this measured form each time. That's a little bit different, but a little bit more reluctant to engage type thing, but he's finding ways to win. It is a miraculous career, man. I remember the first time I saw him was UFC 82 when I was at the in Columbus, and remember they had put him on the prelims as kind of like a reprimand for his contract and all that was going on, like his last fight on his contract, so they didn't put him on the main card. Here we are, dude, all these years later, 12 years later, a dozen years later, and he's still fighting in the UFC. I know he's went outside of it too, but he's still in the UFC. It's inexplicable. It just doesn't happen for guys like that.
Right. Well, that in and of itself is weird. Guys that it's so rare for a guy to leave the UFC, come back and then stay in for, another decade or whatever. I'd have to look at this guy, but like that is preposterous. And the reason he's able to do it is because the guy really still loves the sport. It's like, you can see he is, before every fight now, when they do the interview, he's like, you know, I tweaked my style a little bit. I'd made some adjustments. It's like, he's constantly tinkering with the game plan and working on his skills, and he can still do it. I mean, it's incredible to watch.
Oh man. So many cool storylines coming out of Wednesday's night. It was a really violent night out there in Jacksonville. A lot happened. As we said, we covered most of it. We still have a lot left to get to today, though. We're going to talk Conor McGregor, and we're going to preview Saturday's card on the other side. We'll be right back. All right, gentlemen, we are back. And you knew this was going to happen. You knew that this was going to happen. It was inevitable. All these lightweights were out here getting all the attention. You knew Conor McGregor was going to feel left out, and he was going to make his presence known at some point. And he did. This is what happens when we do this show. We've taped the show, and then things happen a couple hours after we tape the show, and instantly we lose a segment or something like that. Yeah. And on Monday, that's what this man did. Conor McGregor tweeted a lot. A tweet storm, you might say.
Mm-hmm.
Ends up getting in this long diatribe about Khabib, Tony, all of us, lightweight division. Says Dustin should fight Tony, Dustin Poirier, obviously, and then says this about Justin Gaethje. Quote, try and dance around what the real threat is, hear all you want. I'm going to fucking butcher you. Your teeth, I'm going to put them on a fucking necklace. Speak on my skills as a father, you are fucking dead.
Yes.
That's aggressive. He calls to fight Justin next, says Justin shouldn't fight Khabib, that he should fight Conor. Justin's camp then scoffs essentially and says, Conor, you had the chance, my man. It's not happening. This is all quite funny to me because Justin Gaethje has been doing everything in his power to call out Conor McGregor and get his attention for the better part of almost 2 years.
Right.
And now suddenly he has vaulted over Conor completely. Thoughts after seeing this?
Okay, so first of all, let's address the last thing you said. Give me a break, man. Justin Gaethje would love that fight. They can posture all they want, but dude, that is the biggest payday, and it's also a stylistic thing that I think that he's licking his lips, right? Like, he would want to fight Conor McGregor. I think everything about that fight is desirable from probably both sides now, and I think that Conor has understood like the whole way. That's kind of an ace in his pot, in his sleeve, you know, that type of thing. Like, if it comes down to it and Gaethje is available, like, that's a fight he might want. So I wasn't surprised to see any of this, man. I think that Conor is probably weighing his stuff. He wants this summer return. He's probably looking at the schedule and probably seeing that won't happen for Gaethje and Nurmagomedov. And he's inserting himself into that conversation brilliantly and forecastingly, just like he's done his whole career. So I almost expected it. I remember when we were talking about this back on Monday, I was basically like, you know, the one kind of X factor in all of this is Conor McGregor. Well, here's the X factor chiming in. And if anybody's going to steer it in a different direction, it's going to be him, right?
Yeah. I mean, it is ridiculous, though, for him to now be calling for a fight with Justin Gaethje and that.
Right.
You know, I mean, that
Gaethje's been trying to get this man to say his name for so long at this point.
Right, and then to now pretend that, like, Gaethje's ducking him is silly. But I think, Chuck, you're right. I mean, it's really, at this point, it's up to Gaethje because he could take that Conor fight and go for the payday, or he could go for the belt, you know, which is, I don't know which fight I'm more intrigued by. I mean, I think stylistically, obviously, Conor and Gaethje is going to be a war. That's going to be a really fun one. But still, now I'm intrigued to see what would happen in a Gaethje-Khabib fight. To see if Gaethje could use his wrestling and keep the fight standing. So, not surprised that Conor did this, but then not to jump the gun. Also, then he does all this like really aggressive tweeting. He's mad at everybody. He's going crazy. And then the next day we find out about, you know, Khabib's dad potentially is in a coma. He's having issues. Yeah. And then Conor's like praying for the Nurmagomedov family. It's just like weird juxtaposition with Conor. Yes. And then you see all the comments, people being like, this is the real Conor. It's like, I don't know what the real Conor is. Come on.
Yeah. I don't think Conor knows what the real Conor is at this point.
Yeah.
But Chuck, I'm actually a little surprised by sort of what you were saying there, man. It sounds like, you correct me obviously if I'm wrong, it sounds like you think Justin should take the Conor fight over the Khabib fight.
Yeah. only in the sense that from my personal perspective, you know, he should be like a, you know, 1980s rock band, you know, and have a tour. Wears a t-shirt and he's like, he's got different dates set up with all these guys, right? But I honestly, I've been intrigued by the Gaethje McGregor fight for a long time. You know what I mean? I feel like there's been moments where you think it should probably be looked at or whatever. We've talked about that fight. It's just one of those intriguing things. My bigger thing, though, is the timing. If an Nurmagomedov can't return, let's say, until the fall, or doesn't want to, or whatever the situation is, I guess I see that as a perfect opportunity for something like that. So I'm not opposed to it. I would be okay either way, but I would be totally fine. Let's put it that way. If Gaethje fought McGregor,
I am so surprised by that. I don't know. To me, it just feels like obviously I would love to see that fight. I was all about that fight when we had our past permutations of all of this, and it was Khabib, Tony, Conor, Gaethje. It just feels to me right now like Gaethje is past that, man. Like, Gaethje is fighting Khabib. He is sort of at the spot that he's wanted to be at for years at this point, and it's so hard in this lightweight division to get to that spot where you're the guy fighting Khabib. If I'm Justin Gaethje, I'm telling Conor to F off. Like, I'm taking my title shot, and I'm getting what I have worked for and what I've earned. Like, that's not even a question that pops into my head. Because the way that the UFC has been structuring these contracts lately with, like, the people who fight Conor, it's not like fighting Conor is not what it used to be for the other guy in terms of the gigantic payday. The red panty nights are not coming as freely for Conor opponents because of the way these contracts are structured now. If I'm Justin, I say no way, dude. Like, I'm just taking my shot.
This presumes that Justin thinks like a typical competitor. I mean, I totally agree with you.
That's fair.
But I'm like, he's such a different guy. There's also an extra little element as well, like Ali Abdelaziz, right? Like, kind of the camps, the way that they're structured. Obviously, there's been bad blood between Conor and Ali Abdelaziz. And then you get the situation where you know what I mean? Like, Ali is with Justin Gaethje as well. I just think that there's some weird, politics within that may steer it that way too, that would maybe get some motivation out of Gaethje, you know, if he didn't have it already. It'd be interesting to see how it plays out. But I'm with you. If he thinks like a real competitor in the meritocracy and all of that stuff, like his end goal is just to fight Nurmagomedov and it's for that belt, that is the play. But if it's kind of like the hunch is that he's just, it's not just about the belt, that he's like, he has these dream sort of fights. Like, I get a hunch that he wants to fight McGregor. You know what I mean? Like, I think he wants to. Then I could see it going that way too.
I mean, I think you're right about that, Chuck. But the thing is, after the performance against Tony Ferguson, Justin's got to feel like his chances against Khabib are pretty good. His chances against everybody are really good.
Oh, his confidence right now has to be so high.
Right. So him going in and fighting Khabib, even if it's not in July, maybe it does have to wait till the fall, which I agree that might be, a little caveat here that could change the equation a bit. But he's got to know that if he takes the belt off Khabib, he gives him his first loss. Do you understand how gigantic a Conor McGregor, Justin Gaethje title fight is at that point? I mean, it's absurd. Not that Conor even needs any extra, spice to his fights, but that would definitely add an element. And I got to tell you, I still think Conor needs a fight. I think he needs to fight one more guy before he gets a title shot,
That's another thing, The other thing, too, obviously, is like the timing and the schedule. If the schedule is basically resuming, I know that they're talking about this Fight Island, but if the schedule's basically taking it to Vegas, obviously the Nurmagomedov Vegas stuff also comes into play. There's just so much to actually, think about in terms of like this type of matchmaking. But dude, I'm so glad though that we're in a position where either way the UFC kind of took that thing, I feel like it's huge. You know what I mean? It'd be fun. I guess my druthers would be that Gaethje goes for the Nurmagomedov fight next, just given what you're saying, like about his chance to really just shake everything up and basically stamp his greatness on the sport.
Right.
I think that's his chance. So I guess my druthers would be that way, but the consolation of the other one wouldn't be so bad.
Well, here's where I think this plays out. Cause I don't think there's any way Justin wants to fight in July or ends up fighting in July, because that's, what is that? Like 2 months away. Right.
That's correct.
We're in May. Like that's soon, man. Like that's a very quick turnaround.
Yeah, that might be too soon. Yep.
I don't think he is interested in that whatsoever. I think they end up doing him and Khabib probably on Fight Island at some point, August, September range. And that seems like the plan the UFC is also angling for. And then that sort of brings back up the conversation we had on Monday, where it's just like, what do you do with Conor McGregor at that point? I saw Yahoo Sports calling for him to fight Nate Diaz, which Dan Wetzel wrote this column. He had a very interesting point, which was in these silent arenas, Connor versus Nate, there's a different element that gets added to it because you get to hear these guys. And that would actually be really interesting. I would love to hear those two gentlemen talk amongst each other while they're fighting. That seems really fascinating on a lot of levels. You guys had thrown out Dustin Poirier also on Monday. It seems like Tony Ferguson might be out for a little bit of a break. I don't know. What's a good plan in your mind if they go with Khabib, Gaethje? Like, where do we end up with Connor?
I mean, I mentioned this on Monday, but I think that the Poirier rematch would be big. I just think that Poirier at this point has grown very well and accounted for himself very well through his run and even the Nurmagomedov fight. He was very gracious in defeat. I think he's kept his name very relevant. And that rematch to me would be bigger because he's such a good, you know, B-side at this point. Like he would play off perfectly in that scenario. So if it's all, you know, if it's going to be Nurmagomedov and Gaethje, I would love it, you know, to see McGregor fight Poirier next.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. If for the good of the division, like, remember when the year started, Connor was hat in hand. He's coming in. He's the nice guy fighting Cowboy, gives Cowboy the opportunity. He's, like, very respectful of him. And now we got this Connor coming back out again with this whole tweet storm, and he's calling people scurrying rats and all this shit. It's like, if you really want to come back and earn your title back, Dustin Poirier is the guy that makes sense there because Poirier was on a ridiculous run. It's no shame to lose to Khabib. I mean, that happens. And he does it in Abu Dhabi also, which is crazy. So yeah, put that rematch together. If Connor goes through a Dustin Poirier and beats him convincingly or whatever, gets through Poirier, then how could you deny Connor? That feels a lot better.
Sure.
You know, so to me, yes, I think Poirier would be the right matchup. The Nate fight, I think, is always there. And I think that fight is always there for them, even when it's past due. Like when they're past their prime, they could do that fight and it's still going to be entertaining to watch. And I think in the back of both of their minds, they know that. That's always going to be there. They can always do that third fight. Yeah. So,
Chris, you say Connor would the sort of the bump he would get from beating Dustin. Dude, I think if Connor actually went out and rematched Dustin Poirier and beat Dustin Poirier, like the way that we sort of look at him and the hardcores look at him would completely change, I think, in terms of this lightweight division. Like he is then vindicated and validated in a lot of ways that like, okay, yeah, Connor is the number one contender. Like he is legit. He is
no question. No question. Yeah. A lot of former champions do that. They go back down, they have a couple of fights. They look good and they get right back to the title. And that is the great thing about this sport. And that's how it should work. I understand that Connor's the biggest draw in the sport and he can pretty much get whatever he wants, but that he's a martial artist. And that's what we kind of fell in love with that guy. When he first went on his run, he was fighting the guys he was supposed to fight en route to, you know, being a double champ. So I would love to see that. And I think it'd be a great fight. Poirier deserves to get another chance at that. And if Connor does it, like you said, then how can we not look at him as the rightful number one contender?
Well, last thing on this, because I think another fun wrinkle to that would be, like, would Connor be the underdog in that fight? Because odds work and just like the public betting sort of makes the odds, maybe he probably wouldn't be just because a lot of people would put their money on Connor. But should he be? Because in my mind, he's the underdog in that fight. And that adds a whole different level of just fascination to that matchup.
It's intriguing that you still think that he would be an underdog, though, just in your mind. It's weird because if you look at the guy, he like his losses and things like that, they're just like Nurmagomedov is who he is. And the Diaz one was like at an arbitrary weight and short notice and all that. The guy has kind of proven that he can, if he has a full camp and all that, man, he's pretty brilliant in there. I would think that McGregor would be the favorite in that fight, but a slight one, you know what I mean? Like just barely.
Yeah. I think Connor would be the favorite going in too, but I agree. It wouldn't be a pick 'em, but it'd be like a, you know, Dustin, maybe like a plus 150 or something. You know,
that's
like,
what I'm thinking.
Right.
Minus 150.
I think the interesting factor though, is that it would be in an empty arena or a near empty arena. You know, we don't know if they're going to start letting some fans in eventually, if you know, but that could play a factor because Connor plays off that crowd. You feel that swarm of the Irish energy coming towards the octagon when he's fighting in an empty arena. I mean, that maybe takes a little bit of the pressure off of Poirier, who admitted after the first fight against Connor that did affect him. You know, the mind games affected him, the pressure affected him. Yep. So you don't know how that would play into it, but still I think Connor would be the slight favorite, but that'd be a fantastic matchup. I'm very interested in that one.
No, yeah, I just, my whole thing is I would just really like to see Connor get in here during this empty arena era before this is over, because I really just think that whole adds a whole nother layer of just interest to his fights. Cause he is somebody, you're right, guys. Like, he is somebody who feeds off of that crowd. His events are spectacles. The whole thing is just feels very big. And I think if you take away sort of that layer, that veneer of bigness,
yeah,
seeing how he would respond to that and also just being able to hear him and hear his coaches and everything, that would be really interesting to me.
It'd
to
be like see. One of those stripped down tracks, like of the Rolling Stones or something, where they take away all the instrumentation and you just hear the vocals, or like the Marvin Gaye thing. It would be like that. You'd be like, dude, here we are listening to him, and it is just his voice. You know what I mean? That would be very fascinating to me.
It would be cool, man. It would be cool. Let's keep it moving. Last topic for today. We've had two events in 5 days. It's Thursday. And in another 2 days, we have another event. So here we go. Let's do a quick preview of Saturday's card. Walt Harris, Alistair Overeem. Good to see Walt Harris back.
Yes.
Back in here, obviously, after what his family has gone through. You forget at this point, but he was on a really nice streak before all of this. Back-to-back first-round knockouts, 4 fights in a row he was winning. That Alexei Oleinik knockout in 12 seconds, that's his last performance, and that was sensational. It felt like Walt Harris was starting to find himself a little bit here in this heavyweight division. And then on the other hand, you have Alistair Overeem, who would have been on a 3-fight win streak if he doesn't get caught by Yarizina Rosenstruck with 4 seconds left. Heavyweight is a total mess right now. This division makes no sense. It's bottlenecked to hell. It's hard to talk about because of that, because we have no sense of clarity. So what is it? I don't know. What does this fight represent to you guys? What does this mean? What are the stakes here?
Well, I don't think there's any kind of title, you know, dangling in the balance, just given what you mentioned. But I do think that for Alistair Overeem, particularly, especially coming off of that, you know, basically having a loss, you know, snatched from the jaws of victory, like in reverse, you know what I mean? It was like he won that fight and then he loses it. That's a very tough one. But if he loses this, you start to, it's always the same thing with these guys, these veterans. You're like, is this kind of the end of their relevancy? Like, do they kind of slip off now and become like the gatekeeper or whatever it is? I feel like this one matters a lot to Overeem. And for Walt, man, like, you're right, 100% right. Like, he was looking very good in 2019 before all of this. And to what form he returns after such an emotional toll, which is, it's almost unspeakable to try to understand. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
How he returns, I think for him, it might just be, you know, what he needs to get to feel normal again, or something along those lines, or to feel like he's part of things again. And so the stakes in some ways are more emotional in that sense. And it certainly would, if you're looking at it and breaking it down in terms of the rankings, I think that this would be a huge thing for him ultimately, because he would then have won, you know, three or four solid ones in a row. I think he'd be right up there, man.
Yeah, this is a tough one in terms of stakes. I mean, obviously, I agree. I think it's a get right kind of thing for Walt Harris after going through such a horrible tragedy. I think just getting back in there is probably going to feel good for him and make things maybe feel a little bit normal and put him back on track. That being said, I think it's a step up in competition to fight a guy like Alistair Overeem. I mean, that is a high level striker, no matter what point in his career. And so I don't know. I think it's a little bit of a risky return for Walt Harris. I don't think it's a guarantee that he wins that fight. I mean, I think I would pick him going into it. But then again, you look at how Overeem fought against Rosenstruik, avoided everything until the last, you know, 5 seconds of that fight, and then gets his lip destroyed. So yeah, I don't know. The stakes are weird. It's interesting to see what Overeem looks like coming in here, but he's essentially, unfortunately, I think, a heavyweight gatekeeper at this point, right? I mean, that's what it feels like to me.
Yeah, I mean, that's fair to say. He's 39 years old. I feel like we're obviously in this last chapter for Alistair Overeem here. A loss here on Saturday does feel like it would be a big one, a tough one for him to take, because at that point, you're 2-4 over your last 6, regardless of how that Rosenstruik fight was going for most of it. But a win here, I think, for Walt Harris would be really huge, because then he does sort of start to enter this mix, this conversation that we're having at heavyweight. He's still not at the Francis Ngannou level at all, and I think it would be silly to throw him in against a guy like that, but he gets there. He gets into this conversation in this top 8, sort of top 6, top 5 mix that we're going. You look up and down this card, though. Actually kind of a good card. Very sneaky good main card. I would say every fight on this main card has something to like. So very quickly, last thing before we get out of here on today's show, let's each pick one fight on this main card that we kind of really dig. Something that really is catching our attention. Chuck, let's throw it to you. What are you thinking?
Well, I got to go with the Claudia Gadelha fight against Angela Hill, only in the sense of it's hilarious to me that Angela Hill, even during a pandemic, still finds a way to kind of slip into a weird situational fight where it's not ideal, but has tons of like import for her. If she's able to win this, that's four in a row, and she will have done that since September of 2019, which is just, it's an insane run. And I think for me, man, like, I think that this is the toughest one. I think Gadelha, like, I always have her, maybe it just goes back to those original fights with Jan Jacek and the kind of that first one, especially in Phoenix, you were probably at that fight.
Yeah.
It's just, to me, she's always that, like, if she brings it, the you know, like, she really shows up in her best form, she's one of the toughest outs in the division. So I'm like, I just like the idea of that momentum kind of going against maybe Gadelha, who's trying to get back there. And I feel like she's going to be in that form. So this one kind of has like a fight of the night vibe to me.
You say that that's the most important fight of Angela, maybe the most important fight of Angela Hill's run. It might be the most important fight of her career, man.
That's true.
Yeah, I think it is.
That's true.
I totally agree with you. You look at Claudia Gadelha, I feel like the way we view her has been diminished a little bit, but you look at her resume, she still only lost to three people ever. Joanna Jędrzejczyk, Jessica Andrade, and then Nina Ansaroff. Like, that's not not a bad list to be on. If Angela Hill is able to get on this, this is seven fights in 420 days for her. That is a fight every 60 days for almost 14 months straight.
There's no stopping her.
Unreal ambitious, and this is the most ambitious one yet. You're right, Chuck. I love this fight. This is probably my second favorite fight of this card. I don't know if Angela Hill can do this, but if she can, that's going to be one hell of an accomplishment.
Yeah, this is the danger hurdle right here. We'll see.
Yeah, there's a test of her new style where she's really going for finishes and everything. Can she keep this standing, or can she take it where she wants to take it? Yeah. I'm really excited about this one.
Chris, what about you? What fight on this main card or undercard, anything that are you looking at that really has you intrigued?
The Song Yadong Chito Vera fight is one that I'm really looking forward to. That's going to, I think, kick off the main card there. Song Yadong's coming off a draw in his last one, but he had won, I think, seven in a row before that. And Chito Vera's on a 5-fight win streak. That's going to be all action. Those two are just going to go for it. I'm looking at some kind of finish in that fight. But that's like that's a real important fight, I think, for both of them at 135. Yep. It gets them into that closer to the top 10 kind of conversation. So that should be a really, really good one. All action. And I think perfect matchmaking. I think they're right.
That's what I was going to say. The matchmaking on that one is so perfect.
Man. Yeah, they're right. It's at the perfect point in their careers to fight each other.
And they are also, this is going to be important for bantamweight division, but they're fighting at 45. They were smart. They sort of did this together of just like, hey, do you really want to cut weight in the middle of this pandemic?
Yeah.
You know? All right, let's fight at 45. Yeah. I love it. I wish more people were doing this. That's sort of what Anthony Pettis and Donald Cerrone did too for this past weekend.
And it looked good on both of them. It worked out.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're right. One of these guys is going to be the next bantamweight who enters that level, that borderline tier of contention.
Yeah.
And it's going to be from this fight. I don't know who it's going to be, but it's going to be very interesting to watch because Chuck. You and I both heard from Uriah Faber and the Team Alpha Male guys. They love Song Yadong. They have been singing his praises for years now. They love this kid.
Singing the praises of Yadong. All right.
two episodes in a row. There we go.
I can't resist.
I love that Chris just feels like a disappointed father.
That's good. I saw it coming.
Last thing. My most intriguing fight from this whole card here on Saturday. Dan Ige, Edson Barboza.
I love that one too, man.
Really interesting matchup.
Featherweight debut here for Edson. I don't really know what to expect from this because this is a guy 1-4 over his last five. But you look at the names that he's losing to, Paul Felder, Justin Gaethje, Kevin Lee, Khabib, like, come on. That's an impressive slate of people to lose to. I just never thought of him as someone with another 10 pounds to lose. And when this all started, we talked about it at the time. It felt like a response to seeing Jose Aldo fight at 35 and Edson being like, oh, look, if he's able to do it, I'm able to do it. Yep. I'm a little worried about how this is going to go because, again, Edson never really felt like somebody who could cut another 10 pounds. He always looked like he was at his limit at 55 already. Fighting a guy like Dan Ige, who's won five straight, This is a tough one, man. Are you guys worried at all, or am I just sort of like fretting for no reason?
Well, dude, you just mentioned the other fight where they're like, hey, let's not bother with the weight cut. And now you're talking about a guy going the extreme other way during this whole pandemic thing. And I'm like, that's not a recipe for something you want to see, man. But at the same time, if he's been slowly, because obviously he mentioned this a while back, if he's been slowly getting himself down and preparing for this, that would be better. But I have to say, man, there are some red flags. And it's not just that, man. It's like he's been knocked out a couple of times, speaking of Barboza, in these last couple of fights, and all of that adds up to some red flags. You know what I mean? So I feel like this is going to be a tough one for him.
Right. That's what it is. It's like after when guys lose a number of fights in a row or whatever, like over a short period of time, and then they're going down a weight class, that definitely concerns me. It's so amazing that like bad ideas spread so easily in MMA. It's like you watch Aldo, it's like he looked good. He looked fine. You know what I mean? But yes. You don't know how many times he can do that. So, yeah, I mean, that definitely concerns me. I think skills wise, Barboza should have the advantage here, but this is obviously a good test for Ige. We'll find out at what level he's at. But I think the factor that could really throw a monkey wrench into this whole thing is the extra 10 pounds that Barboza is going to be cutting. So we will see what happens there.
Chris, you're totally right. Only in MMA would somebody see the hell that Jose Aldo was putting himself through on that fight week, and the photos and the videos of him just barely alive, and see that and be like, oh, you know, that looks like a pretty good idea. I might have to try that myself.
Right. Like for a while, people were going up in weight and we were like, oh, good. That's a good trend that people are trying to do that. And now it feels like it's going the other way.
Oh, man. Also,
don't forget
two
boys. Matt Brown is on this card.
You stole the words out of my mouth. That was literally what I was about to say. Last thing, your boy's on this. Matt Brown.
Going for three in a row, baby.
He's still got it.
Yeah.
Still got it. I love it. I can't wait for this card. As I said, I think this is a very sneaky, good main card here. It's going to be interesting to watch. In the meantime, that is all the time we have here today. It is Thursday, though. I almost said Wednesday. And so you know what that means. We have one more order of business to get to. Let's hand out some hardware. It's interim title time, baby. Chuck Mendenhall, you have the floor.
Well, man, you know, if you've been paying attention to what's been going on this week with kind of the fight week stuff between these multiple cards that are going on, you probably saw that Marvin Vettori was let down yet again, man. And only that, but then he has this video that basically goes viral after Carl Robertson, right, like falls out of the fight last minute, for the fight that was supposed to have happened last night. And he kind of ranted in this way in the hotel lobby, wanting to fight, and just kind of like this emotional, like, outpouring of anger and disappointment and all of that stuff. And I know people are kind of giving him some crap about it, which is understandable. But dude, when you think about this guy and what he's been through, training through this pandemic after flying to London and back in March to try to take a fight that didn't end up happening, that was to face Darren Stewart, right? And then, you know, and then coming back and all the stuff that's been going on, like having his fight just basically keep moving down the calendar, and then for it to fall through after going through all that, through the pandemic and everything else, I felt him, man. I felt like I understood his frustration, and it was very difficult for me not to kind of just, have like a gut-wrenching moment for that guy. So for no reason other than that, man, just for going through all of that and just the pain of the fight game, like you see it in that way, and just everything that's gone against poor Marvin Vettori. I'm going to give him my interim title this week, man, and hopefully he keeps, his chin up. Listen to that. Thank you. All right,
dude. And it's not even just these past couple months too, because this has been a long stretch now for Marvin Vettori where he has just continually gotten a raw deal. I totally side with you on this, Chuck. Like, I saw a lot of people understandably crapping on this guy for this outburst, but dude, I felt hard for this guy, man. Like, he's somebody who lost a long portion of his, I think a year and a half, something like that, out because of a tainted supplement that had no fault of his own with USADA.
That's right. Yeah.
Comes back. He's only on 20-20. I think last time I saw sort of the salary list that he's on. Fights once, and now he can't seem to get another fight. Like, it's just, he has been, of all the people, obviously a lot of people have been affected by this pandemic, but in MMA, there are a few people who have been affected more just in terms of their actual career and their fights than Marvin Vettori. Like, I totally understand the frustration that that guy is dealing with. And sort of, you're right, it was almost very emotional. Like, it almost felt like he was crying while he was doing this to some degree. Yeah. And I totally get it, man. Like, obviously you don't want to do that in a public setting in the middle of a hotel, but there's some things that you can excuse. And to me, I excuse that one. Yeah, I don't know.
I'm with you on that, man.
All right. Well, for my interim title this week, this is a somber one. This isn't a celebratory one, but I'm awarding my title to the Nurmagomedov family. You guys alluded to it earlier in the show. Obviously, Khabib Nurmagomedov's father is reportedly fighting for his life in a Russian military hospital right now. 57 years old, he apparently fell ill at the end of April with pneumonia, and then things continued to escalate. He was moved from Dagestan to Moscow in May, and he is now under the care of specialists. Yesterday, he was said to be in critical condition. He was in a medically induced coma, but we have some good news this morning, it seems. According to a family friend, what they told Russian TV, he is now out of his coma and has regained consciousness after undergoing heart surgery in Moscow. So he is upgraded to serious but stable condition. That was the quote. Obviously, we wish all the best to Khabib and his family during this time, man. Everybody knows how important his father played, the role that he played in Khabib's life. And so just on behalf of the entire MMA community, we wish nothing but positivity for that entire family through this. Hopefully everything will be okay. We're thinking of you, Khabib, and today the whole Nurmagomedov family. You guys are my interim title winners of this week. Hopefully everything ends up okay.
Well said, well said.
And that is it for us here today on this Thursday. I think, is this the first Thursday show we've ever done?
I think so.
Yes, it is.
I think it is.
Was our impromptu emergency podcast, was that on Thursday? A couple weeks ago? Ooh. Might have been.
Yeah, it might have been. Yeah. But that doesn't really count.
You expect us to retain too much information, Mr. Alshadi.
Fair enough. Well, it's been a fun one. Next week, we are back on schedule. Monday, Wednesday, same old. You guys know the drill at this point. Also, please go rate, review, subscribe on Apple Podcasts. It does help us out. We say that every week, but you guys, it really does help us out. Also, Chris, hit them with that promo code.
Yeah, you can go to theathletic.com/MATM. It helps us out. Lets people know you're listening to the show. You can save 40% on an annual subscription to The Athletic, and it's a good time to be getting back involved as MMA is ramping up and then all the other coverage as well.
Yes, sir. Well said, Chris. We have fights on Saturday. We're going to be recapping all that on Monday. Until then, hope you guys enjoy the rest of your weekend. Thank you for spending some time with us. Stay safe out there. Enjoy the fights on Saturday. We will catch you guys on Monday. For producer Chris, that man is Chuck Mendenhall. I am Sean Alshadi. This has been the Man and the Myth here on The Athletic. See you guys next week.